Hello, and welcome to the Mayo Report on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo. In this episode, we'll be discussing the top 300 graphic novels and collected editions sold through Diamond to retailers for the month. The numbers we're going to talk about in this episode are the top 300 trades sales as sold to retailers through Diamond for July 2015. Now, as always, when we say trades, we're including hardcovers, softcovers, graphic novels, original graphic novels, collected editions, whatever they feel like throwing on the list. And sometimes there are a few things a little questionable. I would consider them comics, but, hey, who cares? As long as they give us some of the sales data and the stuff sells okay, I'm good. Was just looking through the numbers before we started recording, TJ, and I saw something that I kind of want to talk about because it throws the breakdown of the top 300 trades into what I think is a kind of an interesting light. Marvel had the largest share of the top 300 units with 35.09%. That equates to about 139,767 units. DC was a little bit behind them with 29.53% of the total units, total trade units, with 117,638 total units across all the stuff they had in the top 300. Image, third place, 18.39% of the total units, for about 73,251 units. If we look at the split by dollars, Marvel had 41.28%, DC had 31.63%, Image had 12.35%. So I would say pretty typical. Would you agree with that?
I would say generally what I've been used to for a number of months to a year was that DC for every 2 out of 3 months was on top, and then usually Image would be fighting with Marvel. But I'm seeing a huge amount of reorder activity for Marvel. And one thing that I know that we've discussed, or your other host have discussed numerous times over the last 2 years, especially when you had Chris Marshall on the podcast for trades, is that Marvel in the past was had either it was a corporate policy or just they didn't care. They did not put the money and the time into keeping stock of their hardcovers, omnibus, things like that. So when things sold out, it was a very hard time, very hard for people to get hold of things. They were out of print and they just didn't do as good a job as DC and Image about keeping things in print. But now with all this reorder activity, maybe that policy has changed. Maybe there's something different. Because I've noticed that the last couple months, Marvel's been on top for trades, and that's not a usual thing.
Well, and that's exactly where I wanted to go. What is Marvel doing that's getting them this reorder activity? Mm-hmm. And let's jump over to the top trades list. And normally we'd start with, geez, Fables Volume 22, trade paperback, top the list, 14,175. And it did, and that's awesome. That's actually about, 64.79% better than the previous trade. And this is the trade that is the final issue.
Yep.
So arguably, it could have been over on the monthly side, although it's priced as a trade. It looks like a trade. It feels like a trade. It is a trade. It's just a really big final issue. Mm-hmm. Normally, we would start with that. And it's worth talking about. But with Marvel, I wanna dig into this just a little bit, because I was going through and noticing a couple of things that kind of popped out at me as, well, this is odd. If you take the list of the trades and let's filter by one of the price points that's pretty common this month, and the most common price point is either $19.99 or $14.99. They both have 52 items. Which would you like to look at?
Let's look at the $19.99. I think that's more of a common price point usually.
Fair enough. Certainly, it's a more of a common price point for Marvel.
Oh yeah, that's what I meant by. Okay. Yeah, if Marvel selling $14.99 trades is something I don't usually see unless it's like four issues. $14.99 is much more common in Image for the second trade and continuing series.
Yeah, well, actually for their – yeah, because their first is usually $9.99.
For series that will be continuing. Sometimes you'll notice on some of the creator-owned series that had relatively low selling numbers, they have to price their trade at $14.99 to $16.99. And it also – when you've been in the numbers reading game as long as I have, what that tells you also is that they're probably not going to get a number more issues. When I see those first trades of some of those series come out at $14.99 or $16.99, I know the series is not long for this world.
Oh, absolutely, because they do the $9.99 as a doorbuster, hoping to get people in on the trades and keep going on that chain.
Yeah, but if they have to price it at $14.99 or $16.99, oftentimes if it's a miniseries that was always planned as a, you know, short miniseries like the Mark Millar little four issues with all the different creators, I understand that. That's different. But oftentimes you'll see these series get truncated because they have to try and make up, they're desperately trying to make up revenue in their total business model on the first trade. Whereas series that have a decent cushion on the single issue side can afford to do the $9.99, or in certain creators' case, like Brian Kinvon and Kirkman, they have money coming out their ears, so they can do it. They could probably sell it for at a loss if they cared to.
Well, absolutely, and that's one of the best indicators as to not only how's the property doing, but are they able to play the long game, or do they have to play the short game, or is this the entire game?
Exactly.
You know, if it's something that's a miniseries, you're right, they're going to go for the full thing.
Yeah.
But if we look down this list, we've got a number of items, some from Marvel, some not. But if we look at the retail rankings on this list, okay, it goes 10, 21, 29, 33, 39. It goes in increasing order, as one would expect, mm-hmm. for items all at the same price.
Yes.
Items higher on the list, you know, with a lower quantity rank, bring in more dollars and therefore have a lower retail rank. As you go further down the list, as the retail rank gets higher, the quantity rank gets higher, so does the retail rank. But what's interesting is when you get down to about rank 135, the numbers preceding that for the retail ranking go 106, 107, 113, 127, 125, 596, 122, 1378, 136, 149, 500. So there are a couple of these that have inordinately high retail rankings. Now what that means is the retail ranking is based on the invoiced amount. Well, if they're bringing in a much higher retail ranking, that means they're bringing in less dollars, meaning these things were offered at a substantial discount.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if all of these are at the same price, $19.99, and we filter the list such, so they all are, how does something go from, you know, the 125 to 122 above and below, yet have nearly a 600 for the retail ranking? Obviously, I don't want to say pennies on the dollar, but substantially discounted to move it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, certainly the Uncanny X-Men official index of the Marvel Universe graphic novel, which is really more of a book than a graphic novel, with that 1,378 retail ranking, it sold just, we'll say, 11 units more than Preacher Volume 1's reorder activity right below it, which had a retail ranking of 163. So, same price, roughly the same sales, wildly different income.
Mm-hmm.
If you go through the other price points, I found around 55,000 units, I think it was, of items sold with these kind of anomalous retail rankings.
Interesting.
Now, you'll note some of the numbers I was reading off when I was going down that list, 113, 127, 125. Well, wait, 125, that's anomalous. So the 127 we'll see off. Nope. The other thing you have to factor in is some of these are by different publishers.
Mm-hmm.
That means they're different discount levels.
That's true.
You know, a company like Zenoscope or Titan simply can't offer the same discount that Marvel and DC can.
Yeah.
They're playing at a different volume level. It's just the way it is. Mm-hmm. And even items from the same publisher can get a little anomalous just depending which retailers ordered the units. Bigger retailers, bigger discount. Smaller retailer, less discount. That impacts the invoiced amount.
Okay, that makes sense.
But if you've got 55,000 units, I'm going to say, I don't want to say suspect, they're legitimate sales, but they're sales that were somewhat incentivized by a massive discount.
Yeah, and when you're talking, the difference is only about 22,000 between DC and Marvel in terms of total units. That's a complete swing in the number position, for sure.
Yep. And, you know, if they've got extra copies of a couple of these things lying around, like, again, that Uncanny X-Men official index, by all means, blow it out, get it out the door, recoup your costs, don't pay taxes, you know, whatever your reasoning is or whatever, it's not a bad business decision. But it's one of those things where it makes sense sometimes to dive a little bit deeper as to what's really motivating some of the positioning on the breakdown of the charts and just where some of the things are selling.
Yeah, that makes sense.
You know, when I was seeing a bunch of four-digit retail rankings, you know, for a list of 337 items, because we got about 37 below the radar and stuff, that certainly piqued my interest and made me look a little deeper.
Yeah, I mean, looking at item number 98, you have a, you know, 427 retail ranking, you know, Thunderbolts by Ellis and Diodato, mm-hmm. the Ultimate Collection, it looks like. So, you know, I can't be sure. Maybe in a few months we'll be able to tell. I don't know if Marvel is clearing their warehouses out to implement a new strategy, or if this is their new strategy is to try and offer serious discounts to basically kind of restock the market with their material, because that is one of the biggest things that retailers like Brian Hibbs has said, is that one of the reasons why Marvel falls down on the trade lists is because they make it difficult for us to get their books back into stock when we sell out for them or things like that, or they do a low print run. And that's something that DC, especially with their a lot of evergreen titles, you know, especially with their history with Vertigo, does a much better job of.
Well, it's going to be very interesting to see if DC continues to do that without Bob Wayne.
That's true.
And the question is, how much of that was Bob Wayne? How much of that was other people at DC? And don't get me wrong, they've got a lot of damn smart people at DC beyond Bob Wayne. And of course, he's gone. I mean, there are a lot of people I know of just having hung out at the convention and stuff with various people. I've gotten to know editors and other people in the chain there. Bob Wayne certainly was a very sharp guy, but I'm sure there are other people. I'm positive there are other people mm-hmm. there, and I could probably name one or two, but I won't, that they know what's going on. And they hopefully are going to be in a position to influence the availability of trades and things of that nature and keep DC in that kind of a position. Mm-hmm. Because if you've got insufficient copies to get to retailers that want them, you're losing sales. If you've got so many copies, you're having to sell something like the down at rank 233, Spider-Girl Volume 12, the Villains Games Villains Play Digest, which did 658 units. It had a retail ranking of 2,780. Now, the item just above it, which sold the exact same number of, actually, two items above it that sold the exact same number of units at the exact same cost, and it was the Walking Dead Volume 4 Heart's Desire trade paperback, it had a retail ranking of 273. It's an order of magnitude in where the item fell on the list.
Yeah.
So, clearly they had a few too many of those digests.
Yeah. Well, and that is a format that I think, especially when you consider that this is the direct market, maybe have a hard time selling into. You know, those might work better in the bookstore market like Barnes & Noble, or mm-hmm. it might work better in the library market. But in this market, they may have had a very hard time and may have misjudged the printing and they had to get rid of them.
Well, and I think you're right. The format is a lot of it. I think the direct market, myself included, rebel against items that are odd shapes, sizes, or orientations.
Yep.
I mean, I got one comic this week that you got to rotate 90 degrees. And at first, before I realized where the spine of the book was, at the top, not on the side, I was looking at the logo and trying to figure out what on earth had come in my shipment. It so far has gotten the award from me for the worst logo of the year. It was Atom 0.3. Once I rotated it 90 degrees and knew what it was, I could almost make it out from the logo. But the digest size, certainly I think you're right. Mass market is a much better place for that, both in terms of the bookstores, but also Spider-Girl in particular. That's something that I could even see doing decently potentially on the newsstands and stuff right next to the Archie digests.
Yeah, well, I think the other issue too is it says volume 12. So that's also, we run into those issues of, you know, people being hesitant to buy something that has 12 previous volumes. They feel like they can't jump into the story. And obviously me and you know that a lot of times, especially with Marvel Comics, they do provide kind of like a, here's what's been happening, so you can jump in. But blowing out volume 12, yeah, I can see why they'd have to discount it.
Oh, absolutely. And I'm not sure how far into the entire run it was, but it's Spider-Girl's number 67 to 72. That's about half, two-thirds of the way through the run. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there's another probably eight volumes after it, but it's also a continuity that they've pretty much cut loose and disavowed almost. Mm-hmm. I think she's showing up in one of the Spider Secret Wars titles.
Well, that sentence you just said, that might be all of comics right there. Cut loose and disavow our history.
That is true. That is true. And I do not think that helps sales at all.
Yeah, that's a whole podcast in and of itself, right?
Well, but it's one that I definitely think is a big issue on the trade side and why we get some lackluster sales. Because by the time some of these things have hit trade, the series is over, in some cases, more or less forgotten by the time the trade comes out.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think as an audience, we've got a fairly short memory at times. And there are a couple of things that they just don't sell. Based on how they sell, you can tell the odds of a follow-up to a miniseries or whatever probably just aren't going to happen.
Yeah.
You go down to rank 295, we get the Galaxy Quest Journey Continues trade paperback that collected that four-issue miniseries, 540 units.
Yeah, that's bad.
That's one out of every four or five or six stores, depending how many you think are out there.
Yeah.
And maybe the monthly series, you know, the fans were rabid enough they got it there. I certainly did. But I look at sales like that, and I'd have to go dig up how it did on the monthly side. But trade sales like that, I certainly wouldn't rush to do another Galaxy Quest miniseries. And I really like the property.
Mm-hmm.
But that's, yeah, that's the way it goes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if we do jump back up to the top, again, we've got that Fables volume that was issue 150 as well.
Mm-hmm.
And this not only was doing better than the previous volume of the trade, it also, I believe, did better than the previous issue of the series. But I'd have to go double check that.
Yeah, I want to say that the series was down around either between 10 and 12,000 issues for the last you know, maybe 20 issues or so. It definitely had gotten a lot lower, but that was kind of also an issue of the general decline of Vertigo readership as well.
That was one where the whole fate of Vertigo and stuff like that was a little bit kind of up in the air.
Mm-hmm.
And what's weird right now is we've got no anchor or flagship title for Vertigo in my mind.
Yeah, I think that realistically, that's true. I think they had hoped that American Vampire would be that, but especially with Scott Snyder helming it, but with Rafael Albuquerque doing his own, you know, miniseries at Dark Horse and kind of doing a lot of covers and things like that, the book comes out way too infrequently. You know, it's been resolicited and it comes out maybe once every other month, maybe, you know.
I guess to me, Vertigo has always had one title that people would say, you know, that's the definition of Vertigo.
Mm-hmm.
Originally, it would have been Swamp Thing.
Mm-hmm.
At other times, it would have been Hellblazer, Sandman, Fables.
Mm-hmm.
But now, there's no clear consensus or even a couple of titles that are fighting for it. You know what I mean?
Oh, no. I didn't mean to say that was a clear consensus. I just meant I would think that's what they had hoped because of the big name of Scott Snyder. I completely agree with you that of the six or seven that, you know, miniseries / series that were ongoing now, they're all basically scheduled to end, either have ended or in the next couple months. They're, you know, coming up with this big 12 series relaunch that they're going to, you know, launch, and they do have some great creators for that, but it will be interesting to see if the damage has been done or if they can revive it.
Well, and hopefully they can, because I think Vertigo, it's an important imprint at DC, historically, but for the type of material they can get out through it.
Oh, for sure. In fact, the reason I got back into comics was reading Vertigo titles. I got back in by reading Why the Last Man, then I read his political series, I can't remember the name of it right now, and then I bounced over to Preacher, and I the first like 3 months that I got back into comics, I pretty much just read Vertigo.
Was, you know, Ex Machina the other title?
Yes, Ex Machina, and I really like the adult storytelling and the idea that they had most of the titles had a story with a beginning, middle, and end, and they were contained universes, and you didn't have to worry about gigantic crossovers. And I just really liked the Vertigo mindset, at least when I first came back.
No, I agree with you entirely. Having just done a quick chart of the Fables series, though, it's interesting how that's a title that definitely has the beginning, middle, and end, its own kind of contained universe. It had a couple of side titles, you know, Jack of Fables, whatever. But it was doing really well up until around the middle of 2007. And at that point, it was doing around 26,000 units.
Mm-hmm.
And then it started to fall off. Now, it had a peak or two here and there. But by the time it was finishing up, it was around, you know, 13,000 to 300 or so.
Yeah.
And it's a fairly clear downward decline. Nothing that it's like it's not like it fell off the rails and just plummeted or something. But over the course of, what, 7 years, 8 years, really the better part of a decade, that was enough for it to go from the mid, 26,000, 25,000 ish down to, 13,000.
Yeah, it's what I find fascinating, and this opens a whole can of worms, is when you look at some of, and this was when in comics and in a time when there was just so many fewer titles, when you look at the number of readers certain titles used to shed, it was almost nothing. You had so much more staying power for a lot of titles, and yet it nowadays, with these, 50 or 60% from the first issue, and the whole publishing scheme is based on you have to launch at an extremely high number because you're going to lose at least 50%, and then you're going to probably lose another 25% to issue three. And it's kind of like when you look at the charts back in the back in the day, X-Men 232 to 233 to 235, you just minuscule drops,
But I think it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. Mm-hmm. The reason they're getting those, 50% drops isn't, they're getting them because they've inflated the first issue.
That's true.
If you've got half a dozen or more variant covers on it, you've got to expect stuff's going to drop. And back when we didn't see those kinds of drops, we also weren't seeing half a dozen or a dozen variant covers on first issues.
Mm-hmm.
So I would go for more stable sales than, every once in a while you get something that just skyrockets.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. But it's interesting because in the creator-owned world, they still try to shoot for a big number one issue because obviously, especially for companies like Image, that's with the way that they've been able to kind of force themselves into the direct market and kind of take up rack space, which we've talked about in the past being very competitive. But I've read interviews with like Kelly Sue DeConnick when she was doing the series with Emma Rios, Pretty Deadly, and she talked about how they had economically based about how many, number of issues they could do based on selling, 20,000 copies of the first issue. And they sold something like, quite a bit more. And they were able to actually bank the extra money from that first issue and extend the series a lot further than they thought they were going to do. They put out a first, six issue trade, but they're coming back and doing another series partially because they have a big buffer from that first issue. And I wonder how the economics are changing, especially in the creator-owned world, where you shoot so high for that so you can build yourself a buffer. So when you do get down to 5,000, 6,000 issues, and that's basically only covering your cost, you still have something in the quote-unquote bank to get you through the lean times.
I guess that comes down to how much of it is a story that you really want to tell versus you're telling a story to make money.
Yeah, that's true.
And the art for art's sake is great. I've got nothing against that. But you're better off telling a story that's so compelling people keep wanting to come back or whatever. Walking Dead being a go-to example for that. But I certainly think the creators that are smart enough to bank that extra money they make early on or during a hot issue or whatever, that's just a smart move.
Yeah, for sure.
But I wonder if that's the minority of creators, the majority are just, how often that happens.
Yeah. Well, and then the opposite being the creators who hope that it opens big and it opens mediocre and they plan to, a 30 issue run, but they have to truncate it at 15 or 12 because they just can't pay their creators,
That's why a lot of creator-owned books just kind of vanish.
That's true.
The money's just not working out for them or whatever, and that sucks because oftentimes they've got a really great story. And that feeds on itself because if, as a reader, you invest too much time and energy into titles that never pay off, never finish, never complete, you're less likely to want to buy into one later.
That's true.
And we're talking all about the creator-owned stuff here, but these same forces are at play in a very different way at Marvel and DC, for instance, where they basically do the big promotional push, all the variant covers, shoot really high numbers and stuff on that first issue. But the company doesn't seem to buffer that or put that into the pool for that title. And the minute it starts going down, and often it's going to go down because they oversold it.
It
makes the creative team look like a failure, which in and of itself, I think, feeds both in terms of the direct market thinking, well, if it's going down that much, should I bother? And also, that's got to be a little disconcerting or whatever to some of the creators thinking, well, where the hell is my audience going?
Yeah.
Guess what? You didn't have most of that audience. You know, they were there for the cover, not for the content.
Yeah. And I think there's a sad aspect to that in terms of, from Marvel's perspective, they just, you know, for all the issues they sell of the number one and the big bang at the beginning, they bank that as the pure profit. And once it gets to a point, especially at places like Marvel, well, we're going to relaunch the title in 6 to 12 months anyways. And we'll put instead of calling an S on the end and call it Thor's. And, you know, it's just this cycle that they get into.
Well, it's a cycle that's increasing also.
Yeah.
The latest round of solicits has relaunches for A-Force, Unbeatable Squirrel Girl, and a few others. Mm-hmm. And it's getting to where 5 issues and relaunch with the same title? Come on, you can get to where you have 3 volumes of a title that launched in a given year.
Yeah, that's going to, first of all, that's going to suck for your spreadsheet. And second of all, I think they're playing with fire. And we've talked about that.
Oh, yeah. Big time. But there seems to be the belief that you've got to launch big on a number one. Something like 20 issues is outstanding and something to be celebrated. And to a degree, it is.
Yes, sure.
But that in and of itself is problematic. That's something where you could put the entire run into a single collected edition.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we're in a very different market and world than we used to be when titles would go for hundreds and hundreds of issues. And that day is over. I get it. Believe me, I totally understand that. But when you've got the churn and turnover in titles, it comes, I think, with a correspondingly higher rate of churn and turnover in readers.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing to keep people in on a regular basis. You know, if you get to the point where, you know, everything I was reading at DC, well, it flipped over and it's been relaunched, rebooted, retooled, whatever, or over at Marvel or over at Image, just you look at the titles you were getting 12 months ago with the titles you're getting today. Sure, there are going to be some definite overlap at Marvel and DC, whatever. But there's also going to be a lot of things that it's like, oh, wow, I'd forgotten I'd even gotten that title last year.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to sustain a readership that way.
I agree.
I mean, a good example of that, I think, is down at rank 34 with Arkham Manor Volume 1 trade paperback, which completes the whole series, collects it all, 2,278 units. How many people even really remember Arkham Manor came out for 6 issues?
It's a good point.
It's not a bad series. It wasn't a bad series. It's just, it's over, it's done, it's irrelevant now. And that doesn't help retailers, it doesn't help readers, it doesn't help creators, it doesn't really help anybody.
Yeah. Along those same lines, in item number 10, which is Batman Eternal Volume 2, which is, you know, the second volume collecting, you know, the second chunk of the 52-issue weekly series, but I don't see any resolicitation or reorder activity for Batman Eternal Volume 1, at least in terms of being in the top 300. And, you know, this was critically pretty well received, but it is interesting that it doesn't seem to have a long-term stickiness to it.
Well, and this second volume is selling, down 46.33% of where the first one sold.
Yeah.
Now, granted, the first one's had some other months to accumulate reorder. Mm-hmm. I'm not certain that it did, but it could have.
Yeah. And in this month, it's not in the top 300. And you would think if stores wanted to make sure that people could get into that series, they'd want to make sure they had enough in stock of the volume one, you know? So.
That first volume I just checked, it did 5,033 units initially and then had reorder activity getting it up to the 7,878 units.
Okay.
So what, 2,855 or so units of reorder activity.
Okay. But it is interesting to see how certain things like that, something that's definitively in the post New 52 world, you know, where you don't see that long-term stickiness like you do in some of the Vertigo titles or some of the other stuff.
Yeah. Well, and with the Batman and Robin Eternal coming up, maybe that'll spark more interest in Batman Eternal. Maybe it won't.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, 6 months, a year after that finishes, will it matter? And I'm not saying every story has to have huge reverberations that are felt for years to come. But there are some of these things that once they're over, we just stop thinking about entirely.
Mm-hmm.
And when they seem to be shooting so many different things at us from so many different directions, not only are the items not sticky, it's hard for them to become sticky.
Yeah. That reminds me, there's kind of like a great little anecdotal evidence of kind of a general trend I've noticed is, and this is just in my own habits, but I think this is mm-hmm. can be kind of, you know, pushed to other readers too, is that I know for myself that for certain image series that I'm really into, you know, the trades don't come out, you know, very frequently, you know, every 6 to 8 months or even longer for some of the image trades. So oftentimes when I pick up a new image trade, I will go back and read the previous ones, sometimes even 3 or 4 trades to get myself back caught up and to really get myself into that story, especially for the, you know, top 5 to 10 image series that I really, really follow well. And I don't do that for Marvel and DC because I'm like, well, they're just going to restart anyways. And I'll just pick up the issue and I'll just get into it. You know what I mean? Whereas like, I really enjoy the continuity and I understand that it's different in a creator owned universe where they just have one universe to worry about. But that I jump in at any time or jump out anytime with Marvel and DC because they're always rebooting anyways and they're always renumbering and everything. I just don't do that with Marvel and DC.
Even the reboots and the renumbering aside, which is a huge crazy aside, and I'll grant that, but let's ignore those for the moment. If you take a typical image book, it's worth rereading the previous trade or trades to get back into the story because it's the same story.
Yeah. And I'll give you an example, like the Manhattan Projects by Jonathan Hickman and Nick Patara. I've already read that probably 3 times every time a new collection comes out, partially because Nick Patara puts crazy things in the background of all of his issues. And so every time you read it, you'll see something else that he's like just doodling in the background. And it's just great to kind of catch those new things as you go through it again. So
certainly the Easter eggs, getting the additional level out of it. Yeah.
Yeah.
But you try to do that with a DC or Marvel book, and what you're getting is a previous story by a different creator team that's not really particularly relevant often to the story you're about to go read.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a time and a place where it's fun to go catch up on stuff.
Yeah.
You know, before going and seeing some of the movies out in the theaters, I will go rewatch the previous one sometimes. Mm-hmm. You know, if I've got the movie, which often I do, if I've got the time, which sometimes I do, sometimes I don't. So I totally get that. And it comes down to, is the series, I don't say one continuing story, but isn't an ongoing, a truly ongoing story and title. Walking Dead being a great example. Morning Glories being another. Most of the image books, Fables at DC would be a good example.
Mm-hmm.
Or is it 6-issue installments of different stories that are just sequenced almost randomly?
Yeah, it's great. It's interesting you brought up Fables because now that the last trade is out, I was planning on maybe in a month or two when I, you know, work slows down and I have a little bit more time doing a complete reread, you know, reading through the trades. And that was something I look forward to, whereas, you know, I don't necessarily ever think I'm going to look forward to rereading 100 issues, 150 issues of Thor or 150 issues of this or that, you know.
Well, I think Fables, 22 volumes. One of the things that really impressed me at the beginning was it was clear Bill Willingham was laying down plot lines, planting seeds that were just continuing to bear fruit.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say that holds true all the way to the end of the series.
Mm-hmm.
22 volumes, 150 issues, actually a little more than that, but you get the idea.
Yeah.
The equivalent amount, 22 trades worth of Thor, Batman, Superman, Avengers, X-Men, any superhero title. I would be hard-pressed to name any that if you were to start at this point in time and go back 22 trades, you didn't have at least one complete reboot.
Yeah.
A different version of the character. Obviously, multiple creative teams is a given. And not necessarily a bad thing, but huge shifts in the status quo.
Mm-hmm.
You know, are you ever – how many times would you have – and there are going to be some, certainly. I mean, Marvel and DC are big places. But how many times are you going to have something where – what you have at the beginning is recognizably the same, having changed and evolved over time, of course, as what you got at the end. You know, Fables Volume 22, Fables Volume 1, very different status quos, recognizably the same property.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I were to go back that far, what, 10, 15 years almost, for really any Marvel or DC title, it's almost guaranteed to be unrecognizable. Or have gone through periods in the in between time that made it unrecognizable. Now, granted, that's a little bit easy to say right now, having, you know, 4 years ago had the New 52 reboot over at DC with Flashpoint. the Secret Wars stuff going on right now at Marvel and some stuff like that. But it generally would hold true regardless of where you put the line in the sand.
Mm-hmm. And I wonder if Marvel is just, you know, they see this Gordian knot and their solution is to, well, you know what? They look at it from the glass half full aspect and say, well, the way we do things is you can jump on at almost any point and all our stories are accessible. Now, if I agree with him, that is highly doubtful, but that may be the way they look at this problem and just say, well, we need to run our business this way and we're going to do it this way.
I think the way they're trying to move forward is by adopting centuries-old practices. And I'm thinking specifically almost Victorian era or whatever, I think, where book publishers would serialize chapters of a book in The Strand for Sherlock Holmes in other places and then compile them into the book.
Mm-hmm.
And that's essentially what they're doing. They're serializing the stuff in the comic to get that book, that trade. And they really don't care if they've got a volume two of the trade.
Yeah.
They just need another book to put on the shelf. And I'm not saying that's an invalid approach to publishing, but it runs counter to a lot of the reading habits that have, I think, made comics successful, such as they are. You know, the habitual reading pattern, we want to come back for more. And that's not just something true for comic book readers, but television watchers, movie viewers. How many things are we seeing on the air and on the movie screens that are revivals or continuations of properties from decades gone by?
Mm-hmm.
Star Wars. It's the next movie is coming out 40 years in one day after the first one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's a generation later. And that's fine. That's cool. I'm looking forward to it. But they're not playing to the we want more of the same aspect at times, while doing, ironically, the exact same in other regards. They are playing to that with, you know, 50,000 different, you know, X books or Batman titles or whatever. But it seems like they seem to have to constantly reset the continuity, the status quo, or spice things up. Give us a new Batman. Give us a new status quo. Give us a new earth-shattering, you know, event of some sort. Versus just tell good stories and keep doing it.
Yeah.
I mean, I question if the editors from the 60s, 70s, or 80s would recognize, if you pluck them out of that time and drop them in now, if they would recognize the comic market as such.
That's a good question.
And again, I think at that point there was at least the perception of more stability on the sales. I'd like to see more stability here. You know, with the number crunching process, it's hard for me to do volume over volume comparisons. And part of that is because there are so few legitimate comparisons to be had. You know, this time around, my system found, 157 of the items were reorders. 87, I couldn't find a previous volume. 49 sold less than the previous volume, only 7 sold more. So that's, 56 that I could actually do a comparison on. That's like 20% of the list. Not even 20% of the list.
Yeah, that's bad.
I'm fine with publishers doing a miniseries and packaging it as a trade, and that's all she wrote for, he wrote for it. That's cool. If it's a great story, in, tell it, get out, be done with it, don't come back. That's fine. But when that's happening on so many of the mainstream properties, it's hard to build up a long-term audience. And, you know, we talked about the 14,000 plus sales in the first volume or first item on the list. It doesn't take long before we're down below 4,000 units for items. You know, once you're at rank 12, you're below that. You know, not much further down, you start to get below 2,000. And that's down at rank 44. So most of these trades not getting into most stores. Don't know that that's necessarily a good or a bad thing, but it does seem a little odd to me. I would hope that enough stuff is selling robustly in trades that it's a significant part of, you know, the financial equation. But we've got a really odd kind of lopsided three-legged beast here with the monthly comics being the main revenue stream, trades at one point looking like they would take over but never did, and now digital looking like it potentially could take over, but who knows if it ever will. I think digital's got a much better chance at that simply because it's not physically limited to the brick-and-mortar stores or even the online stores that ship stuff. But the fact anybody with a Surface, an iPad, or just a computer can go hop on Comixology and go get virtually all of this content is a great and wonderful thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether it's enough to account for some of these sales that, yeah, they're all right. But I don't know if 2,500 units is enough to make or break a book. And based on how some of the monthlies are selling, they need the additional income coming from somewhere.
Yeah, true. I mean, it's an interesting, question as to how good the creators are at kind of maximizing the revenue from the creative IP. I listen to podcasts a lot when they interview comics creators, just because I like to get inside the heads of the guys that are and gals that are doing the comics. And some of them are really good at exploiting the properties. You know, they do foreign licensing, they do translations. You know, we talked a little bit about Kirkman translating to Spanish, and that's that's basically free money because the material's already done. Obviously, there's a cost for the translation, but with the amount of stuff he sells, you can get it translated. But yeah, there's a lot of creators that they don't realize how much they could exploit the property. And some of it is they don't have the time because they have to focus on making the comics. But it is interesting to see the distinct difference between people who really know how to exploit their creative IP and people who just think about selling to the direct market.
Well, and that's one of the areas that I think the publisher really needs to step up at. Is they should be taking these properties. And again, mainly here, I think we're talking non-Marvel DC.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Okay.
But Image and IDW and some of these other places, to me, once they get these properties, their job is to hustle and sell this stuff to as many people as possible, but not in the let's put variant covers and sell more copies of issues. Their goal should be to get it the property sold deeper into the audience where you've got more true fans of the property. When I was at C2E2, I talked with Adam and Comfort, who had done Uniques and Rainbow in the Dark, I think was their other book. And they had just come out with a book, the Creator's Guide to Doing Comics. And I probably got that title wrong, but I had mentioned it in a previous spotlight. And one of the comments Adam made was one of the things that really kind of colored the way he goes about doing stuff is he had read an article that you only need, I think it was, what did he say, like 1,000 true fans.
Mm-hmm.
The definition of a true fan is if you come out with something and it's $50 or less, they will buy it. Not they will consider it, they might get it, they're on the fence. No. They like your stuff, it's a reasonable price, they'll pick it up. And not like if you do one of these every day, but once, twice a year, whatever. And if you do the math, that's actually a pretty good living. If you've got, if you're not breaking the bank, putting the stuff together or whatever. So if you've got enough fans that are sold on your material and you're able to produce it and it's of sufficient quality and availability and the price is such that they don't even really think about it. Yeah, I'll get that next thing. To me, that's where Marvel has really scored. They come out with something like Secret Wars. Yeah, sure. People are going to buy it. They're going to buy it in droves.
Mm-hmm.
Marvel has that fan base. DC, they come out with Convergence and people are like, well, geez, I wonder what that's going to be. They're hesitant, they're reluctant, they don't come in droves. Some people come, but you've got these properties from Image, from these other places. That's the kind of thing they need to be driving towards. Not how many covers can I put on it, but how many people can I get? Can I find the right people for this property and convert them into those raving fans that then start selling the book for you? Buffy did so well when it first came out because all of Joss Whedon's fans had been mobilized, knew where to go get it, went and got it.
Mm-hmm.
They drifted away over time. That's going to happen. But that's the way they need to be selling the stuff. And I think it's the publisher's job to do that hustling, to build up that audience, free up the creators to be creating, to be telling the story. And then I think it's a different skill set, and certainly the creators need to be involved in this, but it's a different skill set to sell it, to market it, to get it out where it needs to be.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I'm seeing a lot of what I consider to be failures in the marketplace. I'll see some great things, and it's like, why isn't this catching on?
Yeah, it is interesting to see. You can clearly see that they are trying different strategies, and sometimes you wonder, do they try the strategy long enough to see if it really works, or do they have other pressures forcing them to make changes very quickly where it's very hard to evaluate whether what's working or what's not working?
Well, and I think there's a pressure to play the short game, mm-hmm. but for some of these things, you need more time to see if it works. But you can't play that long game if you're losing the short game either.
Yeah. Well, and that's what it will be. I'm real interested to see how the DCU is and how much of a leash the higher ups at DCU will give the new leadership, because some of the titles that they've come out with have not had great numbers, and there has been a substantial gap between the Marvel numbers and the DC numbers on the single issue side. And it is going to be interesting to see how long the people who, you know, at Warner Brothers and, you know, who's in charge say, well, you know, you said you came in after the last guy and said you could do things differently. Well, the differently is Marvel kicking our butts bigger and better.
From my vantage point, you still got the same people kind of controlling things at DC, Dan Didio, Jim Lee, and Geoff Johns. And I think they're all smart guys. I think some of them are incredibly creative when put on the right properties. And Jim Lee's a fabulous artist, a great storyteller, and really damn good at running a comic company. I mean, look at Wildstorm.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you look at Geoff Johns, and I think the work he's done on the Green Lantern comics is brilliant. Blackest Night. I mean, his Justice Society stuff. There are certain properties that he just really gels with and just does phenomenal with. Flip side, you look at the Green Lantern movie he had some connection with and stuff. That didn't quite pull off. But movies, very different from comics. Not saying it's his fault at all, but I'm looking where the DC properties are having the biggest successes. It seems to be, frankly, on TV, not in the comics.
That's true.
I don't know if they just need somebody else helping out in DC Comics versus DC Entertainment, or what the problem is there. I mean, the stuff I found on an ongoing basis to be just really engrossing story and stuff is more Injustice Gods Among Us than, say, Justice League.
Mm-hmm.
Not that Justice League's bad. Geoff Johns on it, and I'm liking it, but it's not got that pop, that pull, you know?
Yeah. No, I completely agree with you. Injustice, you know, I am partial to Scott Snyder's Batman. I still think that's a very well done title. Although reading it in trade, you know, we've discussed in the past how you reading it issue to issue, you could have some issues with it. But for me, it reads very smoothly in trades. But I agree with you. Injustice is one of the better things that they've published lately. And I love that series.
Well, the Batman stuff is undoubtable. I mean, it's a clear success. You know, it's irrefutable or whatever. I mean, it's been over the 115,000 the entire time since the New 52 launched. Mm-hmm. That is unprecedented and amazing.
Mm-hmm.
But there have been a couple of bumps in the road for me with the Batman run, just in storytelling, not in terms of sales. Obviously, it's done fine there. But particularly coming out of Convergence, the direction they went into, to me, was such a sharp turn that I felt I just had my face up against the passenger side glass in the car or whatever. Kind of a what just happened here. But that was the direction they chose to go. But to me, that's also, let's shake things up. Let's change the status quo. Let's go in a different direction. As if the problem is the characters are who they are. No, it's not. I mean, Batman had been telling the successful Batman series have been told for decades.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, some of them very different depending what decade you look at. Look at the original stuff, it's one Batman. You look at the 50s, very different Batman. You look at the 70s, different Batman. Look at the 90s, you know, so forth. But when it seems like we're having to make some of these changes on a every couple of year basis, that's where the frequency and significance in of these changes is too quick, too different.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not a fear of change. It's a fear of throwing the baby out with the bathwater. It seems like at times DC thinks the problem with Batman is that he's Batman. Superman is Superman. If they just weren't who they were, we'd be doing better. Over at Marvel, you could argue similar things. You know, the X-Men, their problem is they are the X-Men. They must fight with themselves. You know, if only Tony Stark didn't act the way he did. Let's turn him to a teenager. Let's turn him this way. Let's turn him that way.
Mm-hmm.
Have you run out of stories? And don't get me wrong. I love some of the changes they do. They tend to be a lot of fun. The female Thor, that's great fun.
Mm-hmm.
For the five issues it lasted, now let's go for the Thors as a police procedural, which is a lot of fun for about the five issues. It'll last, and then they go whatever direction they go.
Mm-hmm.
For however long that lasts. And the fact that you know it's not, it goes back to your comment, it's not worth reading previous trades.
Yeah.
It's irrelevant.
Yeah, and that's why I've gravitated so much to the Marvel Unlimited app is, and we talked a little bit about in the past, is that it creates a field where only the best stories will keep my interest, because it's all you can for one price. I can just move from comic to comic, and if a series gets boring for me or the art changes and I'm not interested, I can move on to something else.
I think Marvel could be leveraging their Unlimited program a little bit more if, when they're telling stories, and Secret Wars, great opportunity for this. If there had been either footnotes or a page at the end, say, of Squadron Sinister, of, you know, hey, these guys were first introduced in Avengers number, 69 or whatever it was. People, and, you know, hey, if you go to this link here, you can go find it on Marvel Unlimited or pick up this trade or whatever. If they had cross-sold us into, hey, I thought this part of the story was cool, where can I read more? Oh, there? Cool, I'm going there. You know, there's so many things they could be doing there, particularly during Secret Wars, which is renewing interest in so many things that they've done over the decades. But they're not facilitating those sales. Mm-hmm. They're not making those links. They're not making that happen. That's a missed opportunity, you know, because you look at some of these things you've got on the list here. Rank 35, Old Man Logan, rank number 9, Civil War. These are things that we've got versions of happening in the Secret Wars battle world.
Yeah.
You know, that's part of why these are selling better. But I mean, they could be pushing a lot more than just a couple.
Yeah. Well, and some of these are great. I mean, Old Man Logan is my all-time favorite Wolverine story. You know, and I mean, some of these are just great classic stuff.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think some of the Battleworld stuff reads better if you've got the backstory.
Mm-hmm.
They should have been pointing people towards the Grant Morrison run of New X-Men that kicked off or set the scene for Ease for Extinction. You know, they could have, if they had primed the pump better, sold a lot more trades legitimately versus at, you know, discounted prices, and gotten people deeper into their universe, more excited about their universe. And it's just a win-win all the way around.
I agree.
You know, I think if DC came out with a similar, service, and it was curated and coordinated well with the comics, they could do pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
Because...
Yeah. I still don't know why they haven't. You know, it's a question.
Ah, a huge, huge missed opportunity. I have no idea why they haven't. I'm very disappointed that they don't. But imagine if during Convergence they had said, you know, gosh, don't you love these Legionnaires? You could get these here, these guys over here. Oh, this Blue Beetle you can read over here. The Booster Gold, you should have read this. He did wonderful over in 52 or over in, you know, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It could have been a springboard. And then... because it's an online service, you can actually do metrics on how things are, how the interest is going.
Uh-huh.
Wow, we released this comic on this date. Before this, Booster Gold, no real activity. After it, wow, shot through the roof. Gosh, maybe there's interest in this character. Maybe we should do an ongoing, or a miniseries with him or something, ongoing, whatever. You know, or just seeing where people are digging around in the archives could give editorial some ideas to where they should focus.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the data mining possibilities alone justify it, and I think it could be wildly successful. But why they don't do it, I don't know. It may just be they simply don't have enough of the stuff digital yet.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, they have to. The other thing too is they have to see how successful Marvel's Unlimited is. I mean, I obviously understand that they don't have access to the, you know, subscription numbers and things like that. But the people in the know pay attention to the online fans and the online environment. And Marvel Unlimited is very well known in the comics community in terms of the people that are very active in the comics community. And I'm just surprised that DC is willing to cede that advantage to Marvel.
Yeah. I've got to imagine between their various higher-ups in editorial and so forth, they've got to have enough friends over at Marvel to have some inkling of how well that's doing for them.
Mm-hmm.
But Marvel is just, from a tech point of view, head and shoulders above DC on so many levels of magnitude, it's not even funny.
Mm-hmm.
You're not only just the digital Comics Unlimited stuff, but even other little things like the Marvel API, where I can go and I can pillage their stuff, go find out the next place this character appeared or all the appearances of so-and-so, or, You know, what did this creator do? They've done a lot of work organizing their data for their own purposes, and they have made this publicly accessible.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a lot of people are, it's like, who cares? Unless somebody writes me a website for it, I'm not going to use it. Great, fine. But you know what? People can write that kind of a website for Marvel using Marvel's data versus having to go build all this up. I don't know of any such thing for DC. And at some point in my proverbial spare time, if I can ever get around to it, and probably never will, but if I could, I could use that Marvel API to say, ooh, you know that Hawkeye number 4 at rank number 3. What is in that? Oh, it's these component issues. Well, let's go look up those component issues. How did they sell? And do kind of a collected edition to component issues comparison, which at one point way in the past I did, but I was having to put all that data in manually, and I just haven't had time to do that in 5-6 years.
Yeah.
But again, Marvel makes that data available. No reason DC couldn't and shouldn't, unless they simply don't have it and don't have it ready. But it facilitates so many things just by making your information available and making your comics available. You know, if people could be getting for a $10 a month kind of a fee or whatever and go read, I guarantee you, if DC had an equivalent of Marvel Comics Unlimited, I've got a guy at work I could go to and say, you know, I know you're a big Superman fan. If you go to this website, sign up for this for 10 bucks a month, you have access to pretty much everything they've ever published or will over time of Superman.
Mm-hmm.
He'd do it in a heartbeat.
Yeah. Well, that's what I mean, is there has to be such pent up demand.
Absolutely. You know? And if they were smart, they would partner with Warner Home Video and have it not only be a comic service, but an equivalent to Netflix.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Imagine if not only could you read all of the Batman comics, but ooh, this Batmite thing. That's kind of cool. Oh, look, here's the New Adventures of Batman from 78 or whatever it was. It's got Batmite. Let me watch a couple of episodes.
Mm-hmm.
They could leverage the interest in the TV properties of past and present into the comic stuff. They could be beefing up their sales of trades, of comics, and just the general goodwill in the marketplace. Huge investment to go do so, but I think Marvel's proven there's a lot of potential there.
For sure.
All of that having been said, is there anything else that really hop out at you this month of just, wow, this is amazing sales or otherwise?
I just see some interesting things. Just one to highlight. Notice the Titan second volume of the Doctor Who, the 10th Doctor. I think it only sold something like 800 copies. I thought that was pretty low. It's item number 191 or 763 copies. And the first edition sold, or the first volume sold 1,588. I'm just wondering if this is more of a bookstore market for Titan, because I can't believe that the Doctor Who license, which they basically outbid IDW for, I'm sure they can't be happy with this few sales. I'm assuming that they have a bunch more sales in the different market.
I would also think in the UK, which is not covered by these numbers, they're doing pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
But I would agree. 763 units for that hardcover. When it goes to trade, it may do better, but yeah. Another one, though, that's a little higher on the list that I think there's probably a bigger market for. I would have thought so. From Pocket Books at rank 145, Zenith Phase 4. This is some of Grant Morrison's early superhero work.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of interest in him as a creator, and I'm surprised more people didn't flock to this collection of hardcovers.
That's true. You know, I think there was... there was a slight issue with, didn't they do some like super high-end omnibus at the very beginning and said that it would never be reprinted and that they only had a certain amount of copies and it sold out extremely fast. And so then the publisher decided to do these like subsequent editions. So there might have been a lot of demand already soaked up by that like high-end omnibus.
I don't think so, because I had recalled trying to order Zenith before and it never coming out.
Okay.
So I don't know if they ever really did that high-priced omnibus or not. Maybe they did and I missed it.
You know what it might have been? It might have been, I think I'm remembering this now, it might have only been offered in the UK market, that version. And when they had so much higher demand than what they could, you know, they had like a print run of like a 500 or 1,000, and it was like really expensive. It was like $300 or something. And maybe they were like, holy cow, there's a market for this. And they're like, wow, and also let's expand to the US. but obviously with, you know, not limited edition versions. And so maybe they thought that there was a lot more demand, but the demand was just for the high-end item, you know, collectivity kind of thing.
Well, and that's something that I think they didn't market particularly well.
Mm-hmm.
If they could have really hit the podcasting circuit, the websites and stuff like that and said, hey, here's Grant Morrison's early work. Here's what he's had to say. Have a bunch of interviews with him, either pre-canned or whatever, to get out there. They could have drummed up a lot more interest in it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's one of those, if I hadn't been paying attention and knew what it was, I probably would have passed over it.
Yeah.
And even if I had seen that omnibus, if it was around $300, I would have passed over it. $300, that's crazy.
Yeah, it was like a really high end, like almost like, you know, those not nearly as big as like an artist edition, but you know those you know how the DC, I forget which company it is, but they're doing the gallery editions.
Oh, through Graffiti.
Graffiti, you know, obviously not the same size, you know, like 11 by 17, but that quality of a hardback, you know, like where it's like bound leather, like they did a real high end version and it was expensive as hell. But it was very limited numbers. And I think that's what made them think, oh, well, we can continue to exploit this property, but in different markets. So I think that's why you didn't see it necessarily, because it was maybe a UK exclusive.
Yeah. No, that kind of makes sense.
Yeah, because that's initially where the material was from. And so they maybe were like, well, you know, much like the Marvel Man stuff and all that, maybe initially they were like, well, this hasn't been in print for, you know, 20 years. Maybe no one will be interested in it. Let's just do something that we don't have a lot of risk with. And they did that. And they're like, wow, look at this response. And so maybe, you know, that's how it went.
Well, and it is niche interest, because if you know about it, you know about it. If you don't, you don't. More people don't than do.
Mm-hmm.
So that's certainly got to be a large part of it right there.
Yeah, for sure.
So those are the big things. Price points, man, all over the map this time around. The two popular ones I mentioned, $14.99, $19.99, 52 items each. About 30 items, $24.99, about 29 at $9.99. Again, probably a lot of that over at Image. We had a couple items at $6.99, $7.99, below the top 300, we even at one at $5.99. A couple of high ticket items at $125, at $999.99, and at $95 an item each at those price tags. I mean, there was a time we had a lot more high ticket items, but the market's not there for them right now,
mm-hmm.
which is fine. As I mentioned, of the things I could find previous volumes of, most of those had sold less, but that's to be expected because it's comparing against the total reported estimated sales, not the initial estimated sales.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But, you know, I think that's I think both types of comparisons, either against the total or against the initial, are valid and fair comparisons. What if I include all of such comparisons, this spreadsheet gets even crazier.
Yeah, there's only so much you can do with the time you have.
Exactly. So yeah, that's pretty much all I got. It was a okay month. List bottomed out at 300 at 540 units. We've seen better, we've seen worse, but you know, over half the list was under 1,000 units per item.
Yeah, I think we're kind of in that weird waiting period where we're waiting for some of the last 6 months of DC and Marvel to get collected, where we can really see how some of the choices they've made on the single issue side and how the direction they're going in general with their universes has an effect. You know, and sometimes it's hard to make statements about and evaluate those choices based on trades or sales or, you know, 3 to 6 months later. But in a few months, we should start to see some of that.
Start to see some of it, but I think it's going to be at least another 5-6 months before, if not a little longer, before we really see some of the shakeout.
Yeah, that's true.
Because we've got to get through the collections of both Convergence and Secret Wars, and then start to see how the books afterwards are doing, how those first trades do, and if by the time those trades have come out and sold, are the titles even still going?
That is a very valid point.
You know, when I realized that they were launching a couple of books for a second time in the same year, it's like, you've got to be kidding me. Mm-hmm. And that's part of why it's really hard to do volume on volume comparisons on the trade side, is so many times you just have the one volume of multiple runs. But they're going to do what they're going to do, and they're going to try to sell what they can sell. I think the audience is at the point where the new number ones are needed to get the attention, but it also causes such a churn and turnover in the sales that you don't hang on to the attention once you got it.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like a very risky and almost untenable position to be in for the publishers. But, you know, we'll see how it goes. But, you know, I look at some of these items on the list, like the Spider-Man, the original Clone Saga and stuff like that. Why didn't they have a point, a place on Battle World that had the Clone Saga stuff going on? You know, test the waters on that. Is there interest?
Good point.
I'm going to be very, as I always am, very curious where these publishers are half a year from now, just because it's almost always so different than however it is at the moment in time.
Yeah, that's true.
Neither good nor bad, just constant change.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I don't have a fear of DC and Marvel stopping publishing anytime soon. It's just there's some of their strategies, you just wonder how long they can really play it out for. And maybe in their heads, they can think they can just keep doing it and churn through new readers. And as people grow up and grow out of the hobby, new people come in, you know?
And if there are new people coming in, that's a wonderful model. Titles like Gotham Academy could be a definite way to go get those kinds of readers, as could The Unbeatable Squirrel Girl.
Mm-hmm.
But if new readers aren't coming in sufficient droves and you're not hanging on to readers,
mm-hmm.
and clearly based on the sales we're seeing, they're usually not. This push for diversity and more readers, great. I'm all for it. But you've got to do that after you fix the problems and the storytelling that are causing readers not to come back for the next installment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't think they've addressed that. You know, they need marketing and sales to go expand the reach, but they need creative and editorial to hang on to what they grab.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not a new problem and not a problem that's liable to go away anytime soon.
Yeah, unfortunately.
So, anything else? Does that pretty much do it?
I think that does it for us this month.
Cool. The show notes and form for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.